Hey, this is Ben. And is your brain sometimes your worst enemy? If you've ever been caught in a cycle of self-sabotage, or your mind constantly reminds you of mistakes you've made, or it's always imagining the worst case scenario, then you're going to want to listen to my podcast called Shut Up Brain. Yeah, I know it's not a very clever title, but it's descriptive. I help people using psychology, meditation, and practical neuroscience to change their brains and turn their minds into allies. You can find my podcast at www.shutupbrainpodcast.com. It's really easy to remember. It's just shutupbrainpodcast.com. Be sure to check out the episode on activating a hyper learning mode in your brain. You are going to love it.
Hello and welcome to the Money Nerds Podcast, where owning a calculator, budgeting your money, and having a net worth is actually cool. I'm your host, Whitney Hansen, and each week I'll be chatting with inspiring people to learn their secrets to financial success. Now let's dive into the show. Hey guys, welcome back to the show. Today you are in for a really amazing episode if you are somebody that wants to retire early and wealthy. If that's the case, you are in the right place because I got the privilege to sit down with Todd Tresseter from financialmentor.com to pick his brain and learn a little bit more about how he went from 23 years old and in debt to 35 years old and retired officially. Although he's not currently retired, he enjoys working and helping people in the financial world too much, but he had the option, which is really kind of cool. And before we dive into his amazing story, because it is very impressive, I want to share with you guys a quick money win that came from Kara in the Facebook group. Now, remember, guys, the Facebook group is free. It's a community where you can interact with others trying to become better with their own financial lives. So if you want to join that, search for Manage Your Money Like a Boss, and you can just join in and start being part of the conversation. It's a ton of fun, very supportive group for sure. All right. Kara says, I worked overtime on today's paycheck. $1,800 can go towards my debt. Hashtag money win. Kara, this is amazing. This is so incredible that you were A, able to work overtime, and B, smart enough to know that that $1,800 is better spent towards your debt in reaching your financial goals. That is so hard to do. And I know so many of us think that it's an easy thing. However, when you're actually forced with this decision and you have $1,800 in your pocket, I can't make the guarantee that I wouldn't be at least tempted to put it towards travel or something else too that's a little bit more fun. So I am really proud of you. Keep up the great work. That is incredible. All right, let's dive into today's episode with Todd. Todd is a former hedge fund manager who officially retired at 35 years old. He loves playing the money game, much like a kid loves playing Monopoly, and remains an active investor to this day. He's also a financial educator and pro-consumer advocate, having authored 5 personal finance books. He's amazing. So his work has been featured in Wall Street Journal, Investors Business Daily, Forbes, NPR, Market Watch, among many other places. This guy has really been around in the financial world for quite some time. If you like what you hear from him today, make sure you check out his podcast. It's called Financial Mentor Podcast. And while you're at it, go check out his free email course as well. It's 52 Weeks to Financial Freedom. And that's actually one that I personally want to be signing up for because I think it's super interesting. I'm always trying to learn more about optimizing my financial life. So it teaches you how to invest smart, build wealth, retire early, and live free, all at financialmentor.com. Okay, in this episode, we talk about where his value for lifestyle freedom began, how it actually started, why he was sick of pissing away his money, lifestyle design, how it took him 12 years only 12 years to become a self-made millionaire. We talk about his previous job as a hedge fund manager, the importance of working for knowledge, not for money in the beginning, how to build confidence with investing on your own, and 2 key ratios that you must understand if you want to become optimized in your investing strategies. We also dive into a lot of his stint in the pro leisure circuit, which is essentially just full-time travel. So when he retired, he decided that he was just going to go travel around the world. So we talk a lot about that and why he is no longer, quote unquote, retired. He's still working. So we talk about that. And I think that was a very interesting conversation to have. All right, guys, you are in for a real treat. I am so excited to introduce you to Todd Tresseter from financialmentor.com. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode. Today I'm joined by a special guest that is another FinCon member. So this is Todd Tresidder. Todd is the founder of financialmentor.com and has an amazing story that we're going to dive into in a ton of detail, so don't sweat it. Todd, thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thanks, Whitney. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, when I was going through your website, I found myself getting very entranced in your mission and your values and the conversational tone that you have throughout the entire website. It was just amazing. And one of the things that I really appreciated most was that you're a money guy, but you're more of a life guy and a quality of life guy. So can you talk to us just a little bit about how the heck did you even get started with the website and what made you realize that life is more than just money?
Well, okay, so we have to go back. Okay, so I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth. You know, I had to work for money. I came out of college out in debt, right? So I had to work my way through college and I still acquired debt. And so I got firsthand experience in the oppression of not having money. You know, I learned some lessons early on. Like, I was really successful in high school. I've always been an entrepreneur. But I kind of pissed away my high school years working for money. And I acquired cool things. I had a cool hot rod car and I had motorcycles and all that stuff. But then when I went to college, I sold it all and it didn't even buy me like a year in college. And I realized that I'd pissed away my high school career working for money. And so I got some lessons early on about, you know, you don't want to piss away your money on lifestyle and you don't want to piss away your life or working for money. You know, that life is about experiences. It's not about stuff. And I had those experiences very early on. And so when I came out of college, I had another experience, which is I was in a fraternity. And so I got the experience of having guys I was close with graduating quite a bit ahead of me. And I was seeing them come back to school and they thought it was real impressive. They'd come back in their Porsche or their BMW and they're making good money in some corporation cubicle somewhere. And, you know, they've got their fancy apartment in the city, whatever it is. But I wasn't impressed. I was looking at it going, God, this seems like prison to me. I mean, I was enjoying my life in school, the freedom I had. I loved learning. I have a high value on learning and personal growth. You know, I came out of college. These guys were graduating. I saw what they were doing. And I was down at UCLA at the time. I finished up at UCLA. My degree's from Davis. But I was down at UCLA at the time, just having a lot of fun with friends down in Hollywood and just having a good time and getting final units. And I felt the bums in Santa Monica Park. One day I was down in Santa Monica Park and these guys are sitting on the park bench playing guitar and they're all talking. And then when the weather's bad, which is seldom in Santa Monica, but when it is, they're in the library reading books. I thought, God, these guys have better lifestyle than most of my friends graduating from college do. And, you know, that's obviously a stretch, but you get the point. And so I just realized, I committed, I said, you know, if I have to lead an economic life, if I have to work for money, I'm going to design it for freedom. Mm. I'm going to design my finances. I'm going to design how I organize my life to result in freedom. That's both in how I create my work and that's in what I do with my money to ultimately result in financial freedom. And so that was a commitment I became very clear on right as I came out of college. And so then I went through a whole process of lifestyle design to create it, and it worked. It worked. I mean, that's why I was financially independent at age 35, which obviously from the gray hairs was a long time ago.
I don't know. I think that's one of the cool things that I liked about your story was you had no silver spoon, as you mentioned. So this wasn't right. Something like, oh, I inherited a lot of money. That's not what the case was for you. It was hard earned. And you went from 23 years old with $0 to
with debt.
Student loans.
I had student loan debt.
Oh, see, and then to 35, just 12 years, you're able to get your self-made millionaire. So that is amazing. I'm not quite 30. So hearing that, I'm like, holy crap, I need to step up my game. But what did you do to get there? Like, can you share any tips from how you in just 12 years made that happen?
Well, what I did was I was clear that if you're going to become financially independent, you have to become a master investor, because you're never truly independent as long as you're dependent on somebody else for investment advice. Mm-hmm. And so I felt, well, okay, I was fascinated by the subject. I've always been fascinated by creating money machines, if you will, and whether that's in a business or through investment portfolio or real estate, it's always been something that's interested me. And so I went into the hedge fund business, which wasn't even called the hedge fund business back then. It was called private placement partnerships. It didn't have the sexy moniker, so it was way kind of ahead of its time. But they were all skill-based investment strategies. And I went in there, and my job was to research what worked, what didn't, and why. And so basically, I got paid to learn how to invest. I was kind of the research guy that proved out all the models. So basically what I did was I highly leveraged what I was doing, right? So I was going out and making good money, but then I was building the knowledge base that I was required as part of my job. So I was working for knowledge. I wasn't just working for money. Now, I didn't get paid much in the beginning, okay? And this is a key distinction people want to get. You want to work for knowledge because ultimately it will compound and be worth way more in the long term. And so what I, like, for example, I had an offer. I was, as I said, I was down at UCLA. I had an offer for these really high-end investment firms down in Los Angeles, and I turned them down for a much less lucrative startup position, but I was doing the investment research because I wanted the knowledge. And it paid, because eventually what happened was I developed some stuff that worked, and I became the person that really knew this stuff deep down. And so eventually the firm made me a partner, because my knowledge became so valuable that I had developed that the firm moved me to partner status. I then became a percentage owner in the profits. And so as we grew the firm, my income magnified and multiplied. And so I went from not making, I mean, I was making a fraction of what my peers were coming out of college. I was really just getting by on a college kid lifestyle, to all of a sudden I was making middle six figures. Wow. And yeah, and so then it wasn't that hard, because I never raised my lifestyle. I've never been a guy that was enamored with stuff. And so what I did was I kept the lifestyle down, and it's very easy to save a high percentage of your savings when you're making a whole lot. Mm-hmm. Or I'm sorry, save a high percentage of your income when you're making a whole lot and you don't have a big need for spending it. And so I just socked away 70-80%, and it wasn't that hard to become financially independent pretty quick.
That's incredible. There's a couple things that I want to dig into. And the first one is this whole taking ownership of investing and being empowered mm-hmm. to do it yourself. I know that's scary for a lot of people. So for someone listening that is maybe currently relying solely on a financial advisor, how do they start to build their confidence with investing? Do you have any tips around that?
Yeah, you first have to master the basics, which is, you know, buy and hold passive asset index asset allocation. I mean, the first principle is you have to understand that costs matter. Mm-hmm. And so one of the smartest things you can do is get rid of your advisor and go to all low cost investing. Basically, I mean, there's several good books on passive index asset allocation. It's the starting point. Pretty much you can say everything you have to know about passive index allocation in a paragraph. I mean, it's that simple, right? It's just, it's not rocket science at all. So there's no reason for anybody to be intimidated. There's no reason for somebody to pay an advisor 1% a year to implement it for you. It's absolutely ridiculous. We can go through how your financial advisor costs you 75% of your retirement income, if that would interest you. Yeah. Because again, it's just straight math. And so there's a basic principle, which is costs matter a lot. And so if you're going to, since 90 some odd percent of the financial advisors are implementing passive index strategies mm-hmm. or closet passive strategies using active funds, you really gain very little for all your management fees. And again, this is well-documented research. I'm not saying anything controversial at all. All of this is extremely well-documented and well-researched. These are just basically facts, and I'm just sharing them. So that's the starting point. And again, there's nothing to be intimidated about. You can say everything you need to know about passive index allocation in like a paragraph. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's your starting point. Now, that's a valid strategy, but it's not an efficient strategy. Okay. So it's valid in the sense it has positive mathematical expectancy, and over the long term, it will work for you. So what you hear all the pundits say and what all the experts talk about is absolutely true. Okay. However, where they're wrong is when they say it's the only acceptable strategy. Okay. There are active strategies that are valid, that do add value in excess of costs. They're very well researched and well documented. They're beyond the scope of this podcast to go into. But just to try to lay out the steps, okay, your starting point is a valid low cost passive index asset allocation strategy. Get that down and then focus on your savings rate as a percent of your income. Okay. When you go to build wealth, there's two key ratios, or there's two key numbers you've got to understand. The first, and it plays to your life cycle of wealth. So when you're younger, the most important thing is to grow your income and grow and maintain your costs down so that your savings as a percent of your income expands with time, because the time amount it'll take for you to achieve financial freedom is in direct proportion to the relationship of your savings as a percent of your income. Like, I did it really fast because, as I said, I was saving 70-80% of my income. So it's super easy, right, when you're doing that. If you have a high income, it's very easy to save a high percentage of your income, right? Because you're never really sacrificing. So focus on your earning capability, focus on raising your income level and controlling your costs down to a reasonable level. Don't go into scarcity mindset. You know, you can afford a nice coffee like you had in your hand there, right? It's okay. It's okay. Like, nickels and dimes aren't going to change anything, but nickels and dimes do compound, absolutely, right? So, like, I have a latte factor calculator on my website. And you can link to the show notes and you can go through and it'll do the math for you about how much those coffees cost. And that's a math fact, right? Yeah. But it's also a fact you have to get by on life and you have to enjoy yourself along the journey. It's not a quest to achieve financial independence as fast as possible. It's a quest to have a fulfilling life, of which incorporate financial independence into that process. Okay. So anyway, in the early stages of your life cycle of building wealth, the most important ratio is your savings as a percent of your income. So focus on that and then get your investing basics down. Also, when you're younger, it can be really smart to bring in active or direct ownership of real estate, income producing real estate. The reason for that is you have so much time on your hands that a rental real estate portfolio, as long as it's positive cash flow or neutral, don't ever get negative cash flow property. But as long as it's positive cash flow or neutral, over time it will pay itself off. And then you will have the income for the rest of your life. And the beauty of income producing property is that it's inflation adjusting income you can never outlive. And there's not many assets you can say that about. So these are two key things for a younger crowd, is to focus on your earning capacity and your savings rate as a percent of your income, and also think about acquiring income producing property. Okay. So those are the two key starting points. Then as you get older, like me with the gray beard, as you get older and you amass more assets, you're successful in this first stage. Eventually you cross over. Okay. There's a crossover point where your return on investment exceeds anything you can earn. Okay. And so the second key ratio is your return on investment net of inflation. Mm-hmm. And that takes over in the latter stages of your life cycle of building wealth is the prominent thing. So for example, for me, it's nice that I take pressure off my assets with my earned income through the business, but it doesn't make or break my financial outcome. It just takes the pressure off and it keeps any sort of downturns in the assets from really magnifying through the spending process.
Beautiful. There's so many good nuggets. So I hope people are really taking notes and taking this stuff seriously, because it matters. I mean, it really does. And I think that the cool thing
is, not that hard.
No, that's the part I love, is it's something we can all implement immediately, and reducing lifestyle, increasing your income, your earning potential. Very easy to do. Negotiate your salary. Make sure you're your own advocate. These are all things that we can do immediately. So I appreciate you sharing both of those. Thank you.
Sure. Sure. And the other thing that a lot of people don't talk about is the direct ownership of real estate. I think that's one of the few regrets I have. Oh. Is I think rather than renting an apartment, you know, scrape, borrow, beg the down payment and go buy a fourplex or a duplex. Mm-hmm. And get started. Live in one of them and learn the landlording game by living in one and renting out the others. Right. And then your rental unit is all tax deductible. Mm-hmm. Right? Everything that goes into that building is all tax deductible. You're being way more efficient. There's a concept in wealth building called your income translation, how efficiently you translate your income into wealth. And so what I'm sharing on the real estate side is a very efficient way to translate your income and control expenses.
But Todd, we're millennials. We want to go travel the world and not be tied down.
So do I. I'm not a millennial. I'm the tail end of the baby boomer. I love that. But you know, here's the funny thing. You know, that goes into what I call the pro leisure circuit.
Yes.
Right. And that's this idea. Oh, you know, I got to go become financially independent, and then I'm going to go vagabond around the world, and I'm going to be on the pro leisure circuit forever. And it's such nonsense. You know, I lived it. It's cool for 6 months. Mm-hmm. You know, like, so when I sold the hedge fund, you know, at that point I was air quotes for you, financially independent, or retired, I guess you'd call it. And so I married my then girlfriend, who's now my wife, and we went off and we traveled the world. We put backpacks on. I'd always wanted to backpack travel. Yeah. And so we put backpacks on and lived out of backpacks for about 6 months, vagabonding around. And it was really cool. I'd always wanted to do it. I have no regrets doing it. But what was interesting was about 2 months into the trip, it started changing from the vacation of a lifetime to just what you do with your days, right? Like you go exchange your currency, you stay at your hotel, you go see the sites. You know, the church always has the highest point in each town, in these medieval towns and stuff. And it's like, there's these patterns that you go through. You have to pick your meals, you know, where you're going to have breakfast, where you're going to have lunch, where you're going to have dinner, you know, what are you going to do that evening? And so like self-entertainment becomes your sole occupation. And it's fine. It's great. I think I love, like I travel, we vacation probably between 3 and 4 months a year right now. Okay. Which is about our ideal. And it's punctuated by when the kids are in school, then I work my tail off. And when the kids are out of school or on break, then we do other stuff. And so to me, that's been the balance point. I found that full-time travel, it just becomes a job, and full-time work sucks too. And so it's kind of like you want this balance point where it's truly a vacation. And I found that vacations last about a month to 2 months for me. You know, 2 months, we just did a 2 month trip in Europe last summer.
Nice, man. Where'd you go?
We did Paris for about a week and a half, and then we did the Camino de Santiago.
Do
you know what that is?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. So for people that don't know, it's you basically hike across Spain. And it's an old pilgrimage trail that goes through like Nowheresville out in the middle of Spain. So you truly experience the countryside of Spain, including a lot of the major cities too. And so, it's like 500 miles, you know, something like that. So our whole family hiked 500 miles across Spain, starting in France and going across Spain to the coast.
That is so cool.
Yeah, it was really cool. Right. And so as family, I mean, fantastic family experience. And so that was about a month. And then after that, then we went down and hung out at the beaches of Portugal for a while to make it like a real family trip. And so it was a 2 month journey. Right. And then I had other trips on top of that. We had all these other trips during the year too. So what was interesting about that trip is that one really worked at 2 months. Usually for me, it's kind of a month, 6 weeks, is where it's really a vacation. This one, because it varied so much. You know, it started with city and Paris and kind of acclimating and all that. And then it moved over to a long-term hike across the countryside for a month. And that included some mountain biking along the way. And then we went to the beaches of Portugal. So so much variability in the trip that it worked to be gone 2 months. But even at the end, I was like, okay, I'm ready to get back. There's stuff I want to do. You know, like I was ready to, like I had had my play. It was fun. And now I want to get back to writing. I want to get back to other things that mean something to me also. You know, like these are all part of a full life. And I think that's the thing people miss when they get focused, overly focused on the pro leisure circuit is the pro leisure circuit sounds really cool when you're working your tail off. The man owns you. You see no end in sight. And all you think about is an endless vacation. It ain't an endless vacation when you actually live it. And so, it's, I prefer to think in terms of creating a life so wonderful that you never want to retire from it. Right. So that's really the goal. You want to create a life so good that you never want to retire from it. Like financial manner, I don't ever see myself selling it.
Good.
I mean, why would I? It's a community. It's my community. You know, I don't get why I would get rid of it. I just want to keep building it and adding to it and growing it.
Let's talk a little bit about Financial Mentor as well. So if people go there, what kind of content can they expect to see?
Not the usual stuff. So I write extremely detailed, analytical, long copy. I would be deemed advanced investment strategy, advanced retirement planning, advanced wealth building. So I'm kind of the next step, right? I'm the place you go after you've done the basics that everybody else talks about. Like almost all the blogs talk about frugality, 7 tips to save more money, you know, how to get a raise, you know, that's what everybody's focused on. And that's cool, right? Because everybody needs that, right? That's what the mainstream is at, right? So that's where the mainstream bloggers are at. I'm in this niche that's about the next step. So that's what people can expect.
I think that's cool too. Cause it, as you mentioned, that mainstream's all paying off debt, budgeting, that kind of stuff. And I mean, I'm there. That's exactly what I do too.
Yeah.
But it's hard to find good detailed posts about that next step. So now for myself personally, I'm to that point where I'm trying to optimize my investing even further and learning more. And it's hard to find good content. So I appreciate that that's the niche you chose and that's the niche that you went down. I think that's a really cool area to be in.
Yeah, the distinction is, thanks. The distinction is I'm one of the few people in the space that came from the investment side.
Right.
Right. So I was in the rocket science of investing. I'm a quant investor, right? Quantitative investor. I spent 12 years researching this stuff, creating, you know, computer algorithmic trading systems. So, you know, that's my background. And then I became a writer, right? Like, it's so upside down. Whereas almost all the bloggers, they're writers at the core. And where I learned this, where I live, is kind of interesting. If you go on my site, I've got one of the largest collections of financial calculators on the internet, right? You probably saw it.
I did see that. Like,
yeah, it was like 80 financial calculators, because ultimately investing in wealth and everything is all about math,
right?
But math scares people. A lot of people aren't comfortable with math or math phobics, whatever. And so I have all these calculators that do the math for you, right? They're all plug and play useful, and they do all the calculations. And I created them because I need them for working with my clients, right? So I'd be working with a coaching client, and we'd need a future value equation, or we need to do a wealth plan. And so we'd had, and so I started building a suite of financial calculators. But I lost my storyline. I'm sorry. See,
you're about writing. You were talking about writing.
Oh, right. And so where I learned that most bloggers are really writers at the core, and they're not really financial experts, was then I made the calculators available for a brief period of time as a plugin where they could embed them in their posts.
Sweet.
And you know what the response from almost everybody was? Why would I do that?
Oh, no way.
Yeah. They couldn't understand why they would make their post interactive, where a person could actually test out what they had written by using a calculator and proving it out to themselves using their actual numbers. And like literally it was crickets. Only the most advanced bloggers, like the very top guys in the game, found any use for it. And then what happened is a bunch of spammers were using it, and I had to shut it down. But the actual bloggers, I was stunned. I was stunned that all these guys were right. They're like, why would I put that in the middle of my writing? And I'm like, oh my God, you don't get it. It's a numbers game. It's math, dude. Your writing is like, it's like this pale comparison to what the numbers actually show. Words are like this vague reference.
Oh my God, that's so frustrating too.
Yeah,
but that's
part of the learning.
That's life sometimes. So you're touching on another really cool point, and I'm loving this conversation because this is super nerdy for me, but I like it. So
money nerds.
I know. I mean, why not? That's what we do here. So
nerd out.
We do. You have to, right? You have to have fun on occasion. So with the whole concept of you're touching on the financial bloggers, and I, again, at the core, I'm definitely more of a money nerd blogger myself, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that should be where you go for all of your detailed information. So this whole concept between a blogger and an investment expert, can you talk a little bit about that? It sounds like that's something you're maybe a little bit passionate about too.
Yeah. Like I don't read any of the blogs. I mean, there's some I'll read, like if I'm doing research for a post or something, I'll read stuff. But I do read like academic research journals. Mm-hmm. I mean, you want to get really nerdy, right? And there's guys that run research-based blogs, you know, so I'll read some of that stuff. There's a lot of stuff being developed, a lot of new research coming out. So that's what I focus on. But I mean, I'm really, if you want to get down, I'm the ultimate nerd on this stuff because like I don't watch any TV, but I love good movies. Right. So we have like a home theater downstairs with this crazy sound system. I love good movies. Right. But I don't watch any television. We don't even have cable.
No TV, no Netflix, no Hulu, nothing.
Well, Netflix we have because then we get some movies.
Because you get your movies. That's
fine. Yeah. We get some movies, but I don't have any regular channels. I can't. Awesome. I think the only time I've watched regular TV is my daughter plays basketball and she loves to watch basketball sometimes. So I'll watch basketball with her. And I used to play, but that's about the only time I watch regular TV.
I love it. What kind of movies are you watching?
Well, lately my daughter's really into Marvel. I've been seeing the Bang Bang Shoot 'em Ups. Looking forward to it's a wide range.
I love that.
A lot.
Yeah, yeah. There's some – the Marvel ones I've been very impressed with. They are incredible. And then how they're recreating some of them, I think it's such a cool thing. And I'm with you on that. I can geek out on Marvel movies too.
The amazing story on that is that the whole Marvel franchise, all the intellectual property was sold for like almost nothing before they started converting them into the movies. Because, you know, as a comic book empire, it was declining. Right. Somebody bought an incredible bargain and then built it up out of this movie empire. So it's really an interesting business story.
That's incredible. I love that too. And then you mentioned you have two kids. Is that correct?
Yeah, two kids.
What kinds of stuff are you teaching your kids about money now?
Yeah, that's a question I get sometimes. I don't get it very often, so I don't have like a real standard answer for it. I think kids learn from what you do, not from what you say. Mm-hmm. So for example, I'll give you a story. I got an interview from the Wall Street Journal. It was a reporter for the New York Times. And she was asking me about kids and money. Hmm. And I'd given her a bunch of information. She says, "Can I talk to your daughter now?" And I was like, "Well, it just happened. My daughter's sick and at home from school. So you actually can." So I yelled upstairs with her on the phone with me. I yelled upstairs. I go, "Hey, so-and-so." I don't like to announce my kids' names, right? In public. So I go, "Hey, so-and-so, do you want to come talk to the reporter from the New York Times?" She's like, "What?" You know, like I said, the New York Times is on the phone with me. They're interviewing me and it's about kids and money. And so they would like to talk to you since you're my daughter. Are you okay with that? She said, "Sure. Is there anything and she's like right there with the interviewer right there. She goes, "Is there anything I should say or not say?" I said, "No, just be yourself. You're fine." Right. And so she went in, she told her the exact same stuff I had said.
Aww.
Without ever having heard the interview. Right. Dang. So like, I'll give you some of the deal points. Mm-hmm. Right. So, my kids went to a private school because we have a high value on education. I was talking about that. We have a high value on personal growth and all that. It's the best money we ever spent on the kids, right? And they knew it. They knew it, right? They knew that they were in a special place and that we paid for that privilege. They've always understood that. And it wasn't – it's funny because it wasn't a private school like all ritzy kids or anything like that because they had a huge financial aid program. And so it had a pretty wide range of kids in it. So it wasn't about ritzy kids. It was about a very specialized type of education that we were very part of. It's Montessori, you're familiar.
They're amazing too.
Yeah. Oh, and what it did for my kids is mind blowing. So anyway, this is not a pitch about Montessori. But we had a great school here in Reno that my kids went to, Mountain View Montessori. So anyway, hats off to them because they did wonderful stuff for my children and my family. But anyway, so my kids knew that. But then like we would go to pickup and we've got this minivan that's like an embarrassment, right? And so here my kids go on these 2-month tours through Europe, mm-hmm. right? We live in a nice home, but it's not crazy, right? But it's a nice home.
Yeah.
But then we pick up and we've got the absolute worst car in the pickup line, right? Like the kids used to call it the pill bug.
Did right? they really?
Yeah, the kids called it the pill bug, right? Because I don't care. I don't care. I'm not attached. My ego is not attached to my vehicle. It's a very reliable vehicle. It's efficient. And we spend almost nothing on it. And it's the only minivan I ever want to own. When I get rid of it, I'm going to get this cool little sports car of some sort and have fun with it, right? But for the time that we took kids to soccer and basketball and all this stuff, we had this minivan. And frankly, I don't give a damn about a minivan. Right? It's a vehicle. It's reliable transportation. And so my kids kind of get to see these things like, wow, we go on this 2-month vacation. And then like so here's an example. On the vacation, we would stay in Joe hotels in some towns, mm-hmm. right? And we'd go to Joe restaurants. But then we would hit these things called the Paradors. And they're these old restored castles. They'd take monasteries and castles. And they're just unbelievable. They would restore them. We would get like this beautiful suite in this castle. Like truly you're like a king, right? So cool. And then they'd have this amazing 5-star dinner downstairs. And it's just this luxury, like really cool experience, but it's not pompous. It's just cool. It's worth paying for. It's a unique experience, right? Mm-hmm. And then the next hotel would be like this little side of the road, nothing thing that we stayed at. Right? Because that was an experience worth paying for. And the kids got that. We were buying an experience. They had one set of dress up clothes in their backpack because they would carry everything on their backpack for 500 miles. That's right? Amazing. So they had one set of dress up clothes for the fancy restaurants when we were in the fancy places. Anyway, so I'm just trying to give you like this kind of weird mix, right? They're in this private school where like people are pulling up in Cadillac Escalades and latest model Mercedes, and we pull up in the pill bug, right? But then their parents are working all the time,
right.
Whereas, you know, we're doing stuff with our kids. We're off on a 2-month trip through Europe, et cetera, et cetera. So it's like where you prioritize it, where you put it, the kids see that. And so, like, for example, for clothing, they get a certain amount of money. Mm-hmm. And it's really fun to watch them figure out how they want to arrange their clothing with the allotted money they have. Or like recently, we just, you can see in the back here, mm-hmm. my shelves are empty on my bookshelves because we just moved into a house that we've been remodeling. It's a old 1940s house. We wanted to get downtown and simplify our lives. I want to ride my bike everywhere. I don't want to drive, right? So I want to ride and walk everywhere. So there's this little postage stamp area downtown of these really neat old houses. It's a mix of old mansions and just these little 1920s, 1940s houses. And we took one and we completely restored it. And so we just moved in last week. That's why my bookshelves are empty. But the kids got a budget for doing their own room because they've shared a room up until now and they're in their teens, right? So this is the first time they've had their own room. So they got to decorate and design their own room for the first time in their lives, and they got a budget. So they had to figure out how to use that money wisely to get the most value out of it.
That is so cool.
Yeah, so that's a hallmark of wealthy people, right? Is they learn how to get the most value for their money. It's not about being cheap. See, that's one of the places where I disagree with a lot of people. They're always trying to figure out, like, how can I do without everything? How can I spend less money? How can I do without this? And it's not that. It's about getting the highest and best value for the money that you have.
Oh, I want to hug you through the screen. I am, like, loving everything that you said. And I think that's a cool way to go, too, is not necessarily forcing the information down your kids' throats. I don't have kids, so I'm not having that conversation yet. But I think it's interesting that you took a different approach to it. It's not like, hey, you will do this. It's more like, hey, figure this out. Here's your budget. Let's see what you do with it. And I think that's way to go.
You know, the thing is, let them learn the lessons while they're young. I mean, if they blow their budget, then they blew their budget, and now they get to live with it.
Yeah.
Better to learn it now than when you're 25 and you blow through it and you're in credit card debt and it's a real serious problem. Right now, they're just kids, you know, so they can recover quickly.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a kid and you blow $100, it's a lot of money for them, but it's not the end of the world. If you're an adult and you graduate with $100,000 in student loans, that hurts a lot more. So I think
I watched my younger daughter. She was going through her stuff when she was moving and she was looking at what she had spent her money on and how a lot of it is just junk to her now. And so she was having that experience of like, I don't really want any of this stuff anymore, but it was so important to her just 5 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and that she was willing to spend her hard earned money on it.
I think that's a good point. I think we all go through that too. And I know for me, I used to have that whole value of cars. Cars meant a lot to me. Definitely environmental. My dad liked cars too. And so I grew up thinking that that was a normal thing until I started to realize that it doesn't matter. Like, you can drive the crappiest car, but if your bank account is huge, that's to me more exciting. And it sounds like it's more exciting to you as well.
I've been through transitions, right? When I was a kid, I had a hot rod. I had in high school, I had a 68 SS396 El Camino.
Sweet.
Right. And it was all fixed up. I built, I was an auto shop junkie kid. I built a Chevy 327 race engine that got put in an Italian race car.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So like I was a little auto shop junkie kid, right? I was really into cars and now they're transportation to me. And I think I'm kind of looking to try to get something fun, but I don't know what fun is to replace the minivan. We're actually going to finally replace our minivan. You know, all things come to an end, right? But the kids are getting older now. One of my daughters drives. And so she took our second car. So now it's like, okay, whatever. But I don't know what fun is, right? I'm trying to figure out what kind of car will be a fun car to have because we've got a primary transportation vehicle. My daughter's got her car. So this one has some flexibility. Is it going to be a cute little convertible? I was even playing with like, you know, I've always wanted an electric car, right?
Mm-hmm. Those are cool.
You know, and so I was playing, but you can't buy them that well. I mean, you can get certain ones, but they don't have the features I want. And then some guy was telling me about like, there's these VW Beetle conversion kits or something. And I was like, oh man, that might be kind of fun. Like have a little Beetle and convert. I don't know. So anyway, I have no idea what I'll end up getting, right? I'll probably end up being practical and get something practical, but I don't know.
I have a quick question about this, your house remodel project. When you and your family go through the process, it sounds like you do and maybe I'm assuming this, but you buy a house, you live in it for a little while, you remodel it, you flip it. Do you do that strategy? No.
I grew up with that. I cannot stand it. Right. So my mom was the queen bee. She was like decorator genius and creative genius. And she had three boys and a husband, all who were very capable at building things and creating things. Because I spent my whole childhood doing that. And so, yeah, they would fix up and remodel and sell and move on. And they created amazing, beautiful homes. But I hate it. I just want to plant myself and read my books and enjoy my life. I don't want to fix houses. So we did this one merely because, I'm 6'3". You can't tell in this interview. I don't like 8-foot ceiling houses. I like vaulted ceilings.
Yeah.
And in older homes, you can't find them. Mm-mm. And so, there was a very specific area we wanted to live. We had very specific needs of what we wanted in a home and we couldn't buy it. And so we had to remodel to create it. We spent a year looking and we finally just burned out on looking. And so we just built it. So anyway, that's why we did it. It was because we had to, and I hope never to repeat the process.
How long did the remodel take?
It took a year.
Oh, dang. Yeah, that's a long time. So were you guys living in the remodel at the time?
No, because we completely blew it and misjudged how long it was going to take to do. Mm. We screwed up all the timelines. We thought it was going to be done last summer, and we're recording this as of, end of May in 2017. We thought it was going to be done summer 2016. It was the schedule.
Wow.
But just to give you an idea, in that schedule, it was supposed to take a week to 2 weeks to get the plans. 4 months later, we had our plans. That was the first sign. We were right in front of a huge building boom in Reno, and everything got pushed back, right? So then we were supposed to get the plans approved through city and get our permit in 2 days, because there's a process where you can pay overtime and then they will do it on overtime hours and you just pay a premium and you get it turned around in 2 days. Mm-hmm. And when we finally got our plans out of the architects and designers, engineers, we finally had the final plans. We submitted them to the city and tried to pay the overtime, and they laughed at us. They said, "You have no idea how backlogged we are." They said, pull up your position in line. You'll get them when you get them. And 4 months later, we got our permit.
Wow.
So we were 8 months into a process that was only scheduled to take 4 to 5 months to complete, and we hadn't even broken ground.
Oh, that is so frustrating.
Yeah. So we ended up, because I thought I had it all figured out, what I was going to do is have the house in the finishing stages when we were on that 2 month trip.
Yeah.
And then we'd come back and move into the house. That was like my grand plan. Thought I had it all mastered. So I had the house sold. I had our old house already sold. So we got lucky. We had a friend who had a beautiful little condo. It was too small, but it worked. We made it work. And it was right on the back of the Truckee River. Like literally the back deck was the Truckee River here and going through town. So it was just this really cute place. It was just perfect. It was almost like being on vacation for 9 months. It was just this neat little spot that we just hung out in until the house was done.
That's so cool.
We're very fortunate that a friend had that they could rent it to us.
I love it. Okay. So a couple final questions before we officially part. You mentioned that you are a big fan of reading. So academic journals aside, I think that's cool. And I would appreciate some suggestions there, maybe off camera. But for the average listener that's looking for a really great book, what's a book that you think people should absolutely read in their 20s?
Oh, God. I always have on what subject?
Let's just go general personal development. I know there's a lot. So the
I know there's here. So here's the problem I have with the one book question, mm-hmm. right? Is I'm happy if I get a few good ideas out of a book,
yeah.
you know, and if a book shifts my life, then I'm really elated. So like in personal development, and I don't even know if this is personal development because it kind of crosses over to business. A book that shifted my life was The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield.
Yes.
Yeah. Once I understood resistance, because see, I encounter resistance in my own life because I'm always trying to move my life forward. I'm always trying to embrace the adventure of life by stepping forward into it and challenging myself and doing new things. And when you do that, you run head on into resistance with a capital R. And what Pressfield did was he deified it by giving it a capital R. And what it is we're all hardwired with this resistance gene. It's like, it's in our DNA, and it's, it's something where you just diabolically screw things up to hold yourself back. Mm-hmm. You find all kinds of ways to rationalize screwing up your life when you're trying to move forward and embrace the adventure. And so I coach people on it. I see it in every single coaching client without example. You have it. I have it. We all have it. Every listener has it. And so I even deal with it. I coach on it. I understand it deeply, and I still confront it every day in my own life.
That is so such a good book.
Yeah, it's just such a powerful concept. Stephen hit on something so good, and he has related works, Do the Work, Turning Pro. Mm-hmm. They're all books that go around the same topic. You can't overread the subject.
No, because, I agree.
Yeah, because it's just something you have to really know well if you're going to step up to your game, you know, embrace the adventure of life and go live fully.
Yeah. And then what was your favorite trip? Like what's one place that you hold more dearly than others to you?
I'm just not an absolutist. I don't have a favorites.
I love it.
You know, all these things are good in different ways, right? Like I love the trip we did with the Camino de Santiago. We've had some great times in Chamonix. We've had some great times in Paris. I had an amazing experience traveling through the Middle East.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Yeah. So there's so many cool places with so many things to offer. To say a favorite just doesn't do justice.
I love that.
You know, because each thing has its unique offering So I don't look at things. I've never been an absolutist, right? I look at it for what it is and to try to see what's good about it and what I can get from it that, you know, adds value.
Yeah. And I think different places speak to you differently too, depending on where you're at in life and who you're with. And I think that that's a really great answer too.
And like the desert is absolutely stunning. Some people don't get the desert, right? They just don't get it. The desert's amazing. And yet you go out to the mountains, the majesty of the mountains, like the Grand Tetons, phenomenal place, right? I lived at Lake Tahoe for 12 years. I lived at Lake Tahoe. Unbelievable place. I travel the world. I come back and be happy because it's still one of the most beautiful places on earth, right? Grand Tetons are phenomenal, but then the Alps are phenomenal. They're a whole different energy when you're in the Alps versus the Sierras.
I love that. The Alps are definitely on my list. I flew over them, and just flying over them alone, they were so incredible. It was amazing.
Yeah. So, and there's all these places I haven't been to that are phenomenal, you know, like Patagonia. I'm looking forward to going down to Patagonia. Haven't been there yet. That's going to be an amazing adventure. Ecuador should be really cool. Every place has its beauty, has its things to offer, you know, going down to Mexico is incredible. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, everywhere I go, it's just, there's always something cool. I haven't been to a place I haven't found something neat about.
That's so great. I love that. I think that's a good answer too. And a lot of that comes down to the person. If you can see good in most situations, you'll be able to find things that are really meaningful and impactful to yourself too. So I think that's cool. But more importantly, this is all of a conversation about building your lifestyle to be one that you can go have that lifestyle freedom. You can travel, you can have these really cool experiences if you prioritize your financial life a little bit as well. So I think that was a great message, Todd.
Thanks.
So I think we're going to start wrapping it up officially. Guys, if you want to check out Todd's work, which I highly suggest you do, check out his calculators. A lot of time and energy has been put into those to help you. So make sure you go check it all out, financialmentor.com. Todd, this has been such a fun conversation. I appreciate you sharing a little bit about how do we get to that point where we're financially independent, and then how do we enjoy life a little bit? I thought that was really fun to hear the way you and your family appreciate life and go through experiences. So thank you for sharing that.
All right. Thanks for having me on the show, Whitney.
Wasn't that so cool? I loved it. I thought it was such a fun conversation. And I especially loved his honesty about full-time travel, not necessarily being for him, and the goal being to create a lifestyle and a life that you don't necessarily need to vacation from. So then when you do go travel, you can legit unplug and do absolutely nothing and just chill out. I thought that was a really great reminder of there's more to life than trying to hit that retirement number so that you can quote unquote live life. I thought that was a really good reminder for me personally. All right, guys, that's it for today. If you have liked this episode, make sure you subscribe to this show. It means the world to me, and it really helps get the message from all of our guests out there even further to make the world a more financially literate place. I appreciate you. Thank you so much for listening. I will see you next week for another episode of the Money Nerds Podcast. Bye.